Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this weekend's edition, we're going to be focusing again on more of the commodities resource sector, starting off with comments on more of the metals, precious metals, and some of the base metals. And in the back half of the show, again, switching back over to energy, there's a lot of stocks, especially the big ones, that are doing well in the commodities sector. And we have even seen a little bit of life in some of the smaller stocks. But boy, oh boy, that life has been about a month and a half. So potentially still a lot of upside from here. But we all know nothing moves in a straight line. We're kicking off this weekend show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, let's start off with precious metals because, look, gold continues to be very strong. As we're recording this, gold is pretty much right at $2,400. Silver is a little bit above $28. Even recently, silver has been outperforming gold. But look, gold has been, I think, a lot more impressive in the sense of all-time highs being reached almost on a consistent basis and almost a consolidation of those highs. Matt, when you're looking at this run in gold, what are your thoughts? How much longer could this move and how much higher could it go?
Good to be joining you again, Corey. And look, we last spoke just in the aftermath of PDAC, where we'd just seen gold poke its head above 2,100. And at the time, I was cautious, as I think many were, understandably. We'd seen gold get rejected at roughly that 2,100 level three different times over just the past few years. But a lot has changed in the past 4 to 5 weeks since we spoke. And I'm convinced that this is the real deal. This is the real thing. Look, I mean, we were hoping to see a close above 2,100 for the March timeframe, and that would have been the first time that gold had ever closed on a monthly basis above 2,100. And we got that and more. We got a close to above 2,200. Of course, gold has taken off further from here, so that checked that box pretty definitively. And then silver was the next thing that I was looking for, to see if silver price action would confirm that this move is real. And it has. It broke convincingly above 26 and now 28, which were both key technical resistance levels. And so I think all the signs are pointing that this is a long-lasting move. And I would say the aspect that's even more beautiful from my perspective is that this move in precious metals has been driven almost entirely without the support of Western financial institutions and by and large, Western investors. This is a move that started with central banks, largely around the time period where the Biden administration cut Russia off of the SWIFT banking system in the aftermath of their invasion of Ukraine. And I think that's going to go down as a seminal event, at least from a gold bug's perspective. And probably can be pointed to as really the genesis of this move that we're now just reaping the benefits of. And we've seen a lot of speculative excitement in the Eastern world amongst Chinese-driven buying from retail investors and what have you. But from my perspective, the longer the Western world sits out this move, the better. So I'm encouraged that this has occurred by non-traditional buyers. Usually it's the Eastern buyers that are more contrarian oriented and the Western buyers that pile in when there's momentum. And we've really seen it flipped on its head for this move. So I think we're off to the races. And, I don't think this is limited just to precious metals. I mean, turning to the juniors, on April 1st, we saw the TSXV break convincingly above its 200-day moving average for the first time in multiple years. And, gold seems to serve as a bellwether for the broader metal space. This is not an immutable law of the universe that this will be the case in this circumstance as well. But more often than not, you'll see gold leading the way, only for the rest of the metals complex to follow. So, this doesn't mean that there won't be pullbacks, consolidation periods, volatility. But for those with a time frame beyond 1 or 2 months, I think we're off to the races. It's an exciting time, no doubt.
Yeah, Matt, you said it's nice to have a call like this after so many years of being in the Hurt Locker. But I would also submit that in any bull market, when it really gets going, it climbs that proverbial wall of worry where people have that disbelief element. And we were talking a little bit about that just before the call, just is this too good to be true? But if you think back to it, last year in October, when gold really bottomed around the low 1800s, it closed the year on a bang. I mean, November had an all-time monthly and quarterly high, and then December, same thing, an all-time monthly, quarterly, and annual high. So it was already a shot across the bow that things had changed, but a lot of people still doubted it. Like you say, they wanted that 2100 to be cleared. Then it was cleared convincingly, and people still doubted it. And then they wanted to see silver confirmed, like you mentioned, and then that happened, and they're still doubting it. Is it possible that this is how all bull markets happen, where people that are closest to the sector doubt it the most? It seems like generalists are noting the moves in gold and the stocks more than the people in the sector are.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Shad. And I mean, sentiment has undoubtedly improved from where we were in late 2023. I mean, sentiment was so beaten down at that point. And that caused me to reverse course on our decision to build up cash. That's why we got aggressive between mid-October and mid-January and did four different financings, because I hadn't seen sentiment that poor since, I mean, I guess the depths of the COVID crash, but that was unrelated or not directly related to the metal sector. But I hadn't seen that sentiment as poor, since the 2011 through 2015 bear market. It's definitely improved somewhat. And we've seen, you know, share prices of most juniors are, you know, up 25, 50, even in some cases, 75% off of their 52-week lows. But there's still that healthy dose of skepticism out there, which I like as an investor. And I mean, within the MJG portfolio, I'm sure others may be seeing different things, but we've really only seen, you know, the juniors start to pick up, some momentum here in the past couple weeks. So it still feels very early in the move, and we're not seeing anything close to the, you know, junior feeding frenzy that one would see towards the top of a proper move in juniors that should make one cautious. So I agree with what you're saying. Even amongst the more seasoned junior investors, there's still that psychological damage that has been inflicted over the past couple years, and we're not in the euphoric phase by any means.
Matt, even the majors, though, those have kind of been lagging as well. When you consider the gold is at all-time highs, there's very few gold stocks, majors, mid-tiers, or juniors that are at all-time highs, maybe 10% of them at most. What does that mean, though, for the sector? When will these stocks finally start performing? Because we've gotten a lot of comments saying, look, I realize gold's doing well. Why isn't my portfolio doing better?
So slow and steady, Corey. I don't want this to be another 6 month flash in the pan. So I'm okay with this move being more drawn out than not, personally. And I mean, I think we are seeing positive momentum amongst the production stage names. You're right. The vast majority of them are not at 52 week highs. But you know, you can look at the Pan Americans or Equinox Golds of the world, and you know, some of these names have picked up a pretty substantial bid over the past 4 weeks. So I think for the sector as a whole to start getting closer to those all-time highs, we'll need a few quarters probably of these higher gold prices to actually reflect on the bottom line, companies to start raising their dividends, you know, increasing share buybacks, what have you. So I agree with what you're saying. And, you know, we can start to get more cautious when we see the gold stocks at large, you know, going to all-time highs. But in a lot of these names, we'd have to more than double from current levels for that to be in the equation. So more to come.
Well, Matt, like you mentioned at the onset, it's not just limited to gold. And like you say, gold is often the pace car. It often is the ringleader to get the metal sector going. We have seen silver respond, but look at how well copper has done. Copper's popping its head up again. And really, the copper majors have done a lot better than the precious metals majors. We've seen oil take back off again, and oil stocks have been ripping at all-time highs, the large producers. We've even seen some life in some of the other commodities, whether they be metals or even soft commodities. So it seems like a full-on commodities, full-court press here. What do you make of that backdrop in a year where everybody thought we'd be having a recession?
Yeah, well, we touched on copper quite a bit on our last call. As you know, I'm quite bullish on copper longer term, and actually a full third of our portfolio, 33% of our portfolio as of month end March, I define as copper focused. Sometimes there's overlap. A lot of these copper names also have a gold component, but we're very heavily weighted towards copper. And the price action has been encouraging. I mean, when we last spoke, copper had just poked its head above $4 for the first time in quite some time. Now we're up substantially higher. But, you know, one of the beauties of the setup in copper is that I don't think we start seeing a substantial supply response until we see at least $5.50 or $6 copper. And one could argue it'd have to go substantially higher from that before we see the big boys really get a move on with pushing forward these next generation of copper mines actually into production. And even once they get to that panic stage, of course, we're talking a 3 or 4 year lag for these mega projects. And that's if the groups execute on time and on budget. So I think the copper story is just getting started. But as of now, the moves amongst copper-related names have largely been confined to the producers. So that's encouraging. I would say within the MJG portfolio, we have not seen a lot of movement with one exception amongst our copper-focused positions. As of now, the money's flowing into the Freeports of the world, and Freeport's sitting right near its 52-week high. And also the intermediate producers have seen substantial moves. But similar to with gold, if this move is for real, and I do believe it is, it's just a matter of time before it trickles down to the junior patch. So we're going to remain patient, and we're clearly very well positioned as it comes to copper at the moment.
So Matt, let's talk portfolio management then, because look, a lot of these stocks, no matter what resource or commodity they're in, have rebounded. Some of the juniors, again, are double. Some are even triple where they were just a few months ago. Some are simply back to where they started the year. But that does change general valuations and even some sentiment around these stocks. We're seeing a lot of financings come out. I know that last time we chatted, you were pretty much fully deployed in the MJG fund, but what's your advice for people managing a portfolio of resource stocks here now, seeing them start to rebound, still have a lot of upside potentially, but again, valuations have changed.
That's right. As mentioned earlier, we have seen a lot of these companies come off of their lows for the year, even though we haven't seen a huge flood of money into the juniors as starting to begin. And it is true that a stock that is up 50, 75, 100% from its lows, without a fundamental catalyst, I should say, driving that move, just purely moving based off of a change in sentiment, a story like that is arithmetically less attractive than before the move. There's no denying that. However, keep in mind that many of these companies are coming off of extremely beaten down levels that we saw late last year and early this year. And as a group, the juniors haven't moved, and we haven't seen that feeding frenzy that would make one cautious to this point. And then also remember, a lot of these financings are still coming, at least as of now, with at least a half warrant sweetener, which needs to be factored into one's calculation when deciding whether or not to participate in a given deal. And particularly in junior bull markets, warrants can prove exceptionally valuable for investors. But taking a step back, I would say that each company and each given financing opportunity needs to be evaluated on its own merits, of course. And as part of any investment process on a given name, it's essential to estimate the company's expected value, as imperfect as that may be for the name that you're evaluating. So if what the company looks to be achieving is achieved, what would be the value there? And then adjusting that for the risk of that actually happening. Obviously, a very imperfect measure, especially in the junior patch where there's so much variability. But I still think that's an essential effort that one needs to take to just have a number in mind. And then as part of that process, also to determine the level at which you would start to take profits if you were to invest in a given private placement. And this would, of course, be absent a fundamental development that could change your calculus. But the thought process is, assuming nothing changes on the company level, I'm doing a deal here at 50 cents per se with a half warrant at 75 cents. At what level will I start to take money off the table if we see the share price, rise up to 70, 80 cents, 90 cents a buck, and there hasn't been a major change on the company level? Where do I start taking money off the table? And usually that profit taking level should be below what you deem the company's ultimate expected value to be, factoring in for the imperfection and the uncertainty inherent with estimating, what the company should be worth at the given time. So when you're thinking about these 50 to 100% moves that we've maybe seen in some of these juniors, in some cases quite quietly, and you're looking at a private placement that's off of the bottom that we saw earlier this year, late last year, it needs to be thought of within this context. And a company that maybe had 3x upside to its expected value. Maybe now has 2.5x upside or 2x upside to its expected value. And so as an investor, you have to factor that in, and it still could be a worthy bet, even if you're not getting it at its rock bottom lows.
Well, Matt, those are some good thoughts for investors to maybe pick off some of these private placements that have the half warrant or the warrant sweetener. But let's deal with the reality that most of the people listening to this interview probably aren't going to be in private placements. They're probably not going to get those warrants. So they see the financings as a drag on the stock's upward momentum. They see the warrants as an overhang in the price. And we're also seeing a lot of these life financings where they can immediately strip the warrant and sell them, you know, right the next day. Or there's these flow through funds where a lot of investors get into it for a tax break, but they don't really care about the company, the project. They care about the tax break. So maybe speak to the other side of this for all the people listening in that see these capital raises for the companies. There's that balance between dilution and building value, but there's also the danger of giving away the farm on some of these financings.
I mean, it's a good point. I think there's a strong argument to be made that if one could not invest in financings directly, then, you know, maybe one should avoid some of these higher risk juniors that have plenty of upside, but may need to raise money two or three times over the next couple of years in order to achieve their goals. And there are juniors out there that are either cash flowing or have such big cash positions relative to their monthly burn and their expected plans out in the field that one can reasonably expect them to go 2, 3, 4 years without raising financing. Again, that's not the average junior by any means. It's far less than 5% of them. But for one willing to do the work, there are some of these smaller names that present excellent upside in my estimation, but will not have to raise in the foreseeable future. So I think a perfectly valid strategy is for investors that are unable to participate in private placements to maybe confine their opportunity set to those type names. I will say for investors that are able to do private placements, there are a few things to look for of relevance. I'd say the first is, when did the company last finance? And I certainly would not recommend putting money into a company that's raised within the past 4 months, because as we know well, usually there's some major selling pressure with the 4 month hold period lifting, whether you like it or not. You'll often see investors strip the warrants, which is an unfortunate reality of how the junior Canadian market operates. A second thing I'd look for is how much of the financing is being taken down by company insiders. And preferably, you'll see participation that is at least equal to the existing board and management stake, particularly if members of board and management are independently wealthy. I wouldn't say it's an absolute deal breaker if this is not the case, but if the members of board and management have the means to participate, it's certainly at least a yellow flag if they're not taking their pro rata share of the deal. Another thing to look at is the other shareholders coming in. Are they people that you like to invest alongside and that you've made money alongside previously? Or are the known warrant clippers coming in, as you mentioned, Chad? You want to invest along high quality investors and not those that are going to clip the warrant and then prance off to the next deal. And then, you know, along those lines, you also want to see participation by existing shareholders to the highest degree possible. This is called signaling, and it's usually not great signaling if none of the company's existing investors are willing to write a check for the upcoming financing. So that's a thing to keep in mind. Also look for any major share escrow periods lifting in the near future, particularly within the 4 month hold period. You really shouldn't be buying if you expect significant insider selling anyhow, but this is one level of protection to make sure that there's no big blocks of shares becoming free trading while you're restricted with your stock. And then I'd also say, probably most importantly, from an investment standpoint, is to ask the company how long the money will last. And then also, are they raising enough to answer at least one unanswered question that you think as an investor has a significant chance, if answered in the affirmative, to drive the company's share price? If not, even if you really like the people involved, the asset, the story setup, but you do not expect there to be a significant unanswered question or catalyst in the calendar between now and the next raise, why not just sit on your hands and then talk to the company in 6 or 9 months when they raise again? So those are some of the more tactical things that I'm thinking about when I'm looking at a private placement.
Let's dive even further into that final point you made there, because look, this rebound, as we've noted in these stocks, is all just because the market has rebounded. A lot of these companies didn't have any news or didn't put out any significant news over the last 2 months, and their stocks have rebounded, mostly because there's just been a better metals price and a little bit more interest coming into the sector. What sort of work are you looking for that can actually drive these stocks and have them outperform the market rather than just having this rising tide lift their stock?
Yeah, great question. I mean, it is truly company specific, but some of the classic catalysts that one would expect to see in the junior space. I mean, there's nothing more impactful than a drill rig, particularly when a company's more in the exploration phase and they're either trying to make a grassroots discovery or they found something potentially of merit and are trying to prove to the market that it has both the size and the grade to justify future development. Of course, infill drilling for a later stage story could be less impactful, but I'd say at the top of the list is a drill program or two to drive value for a given story. Another thing to look for would be a partner or two coming in. Maybe this is more relevant to the prospect generator model or to a royalty generator or to a company with a couple different projects. You may catch wind that there's interest from partners on one or two of the non-core assets. And those can, if it's the right partner, you know, with the right terms, willing to go to work quickly and not sit on the given asset, that can also be a catalyst that's significant and can drive share price. For later stage names, you could look for a permit. Particularly if it's a project that's deemed controversial or permitting is not assured in the eyes of the market. And for the latest stage names, it could be construction financing. There are stories out there that have a feasibility study out. In theory, they're ready to break ground and go for it. And so if you're invested in the story at that stage, you're waiting for either A, that construction financing package to fall into place without it being too dilutive for existing equity holders, or B, for a larger party to come in and take that company out entirely. So again, it's very dependent on where the company is within the development cycle, but those are some of the key catalysts that one could you know, presumably look for within the sector.
Well, Matt, you've got your ear to the ground on this sector, and you talk to a lot of companies, a lot of different management teams and investing capital teams. And it seems interesting to me that the last couple of years, we've kind of been in a bear market, you could say, in the precious metal stocks, but even some of the base metal stocks as far as the junior side of the business. And a lot of companies raised a lot of money, blew a lot of money, did a lot of work, some would argue a lot of quality work, but it just didn't get rewarded. Now it seems like the sentiment is shifting and people are finally getting interested in the sector. And most of the companies that we're talking to are doing limited drill programs, or they're scaling back and they're not doing as much work. So they did a ton of work when nobody cared. And now that people cared, they're getting ready to do very little work. What do you make of that dichotomy?
Yeah, well, it is ruthless. And in bear markets, good news can often be used as a liquidation event for frustrated shareholders. It's perverse, but it happens bear cycle after bear cycle. But that's an opportunity for investors to go back and look at the companies that have achieved significant catalysts, have created significant value at their projects over the past 2 years, maybe weren't rewarded at the time. You know, maybe their share prices are up 50% off of the lows so far this year, but there still could be value, residual value from the work that was done 2 years ago. I think to your point about companies sitting on their hands or scaling back programs, I think that will change. I think that's more of a backward looking temptation from current management teams, just given the pain that we've gone through over the past two and a half years, particularly amongst the precious metal names. So I think as financing conditions improve, and you know, as you've mentioned, this is the opening of a financing window. We've seen a raft of junior financings here in the past 2 or 3 weeks. I think that window will likely remain open for some time. I do think we'll see companies upsizing their deals and starting to get more aggressive, but it may take some time for that mentality to change. And I would also, just when you're looking at a given name and you're seeing a share price move, really draw the distinction. Has this move been caused by a fundamental development at the company level that is justifying this move? Or is it truly just based off of a change in sentiment? And if you're a shareholder of said name, if it's a transformative company development, then you need to sharpen the pencil and rework what you think the company's fair value is and rework where you're going to begin to take profits. And if it's truly based on sentiment, then that means maybe you should be more inclined to take some money off the table get your cost base off the table and then play with the house's money at that point. So I think anytime you're analyzing a share price move within a given company, you should ask yourself that question. Is this a change in sentiment that's causing it, or did something actually happen that has changed the company's value for the better?
So a lot of times when investors are looking at these junior stocks too, rightfully or wrongfully so, they are looking for some sort of a takeover, some M&A to free up their capital, give them a premium on their investment. We haven't seen many M&As in terms of the junior companies, and we're still hearing from a lot of the majors that they're not really looking down to the juniors. It's been the mid-tiers that have dabbled in some of the junior companies, but those have been more established companies as well. So, Matt, should investors, one, be focused or hope for M&A when they are investing in a junior stock? What's your outlook for M&A potentially picking up for the junior companies?
Sure. Well, it's a style of investing, and I think there's quite a bit of merit to it. So we have, you know, companies that fall into multiple buckets within our portfolio. One of the buckets I would consider the high quality development stories, and those are companies where at spot metal prices, their projects make a lot of sense on paper. Maybe there's some uncertainty into whether they'll be permitted. You know, there's clearly still work to be done to get it through feasibility to actually get it to the point where there's ground to be broken. But there's a style of investing where one goes and looks for these high quality projects that are likely in the trough, hopefully in the trough of the Lassonde curve. You don't want to buy them after the initial discovery hype only to ride it down. But there are quite a few projects out there that have been neglected just because they're in the boring phase of development, but have a decent chance of making it into production over the next five or 10 years. So I think that's a certain style of investing. And if you're to hold those types of names, there are two things that you would look for. The first would be a takeover, as you say. And the second would be the company bringing it to a production decision. And if they have the in-house expertise to take that project forward, that's all the better. That creates some competitive tension, so to speak, with potential acquirers. I mean, any company worth their salt is always going to threaten to build the mine. But some teams have that skill set and some teams don't. But for some of these companies where the teams do credibly have the skill set, where if a proper offer does not emerge, you know, between, say, the pre-feasibility stage and say the feasibility study coming out, if they can threaten to actually build the thing, that helps investors from that perspective. So if you're looking at this niche of the market, those are the two big things that one could expect to create value. You know, very so often you'll have an occasion where there's a later stage development project. You know, you think it's a deposit of a certain size, of a certain production profile, and then they get lucky with the drill bit and find something either elsewhere on the property, or they find a new zone that was unexpected. That shouldn't be, you know, one's thesis, unless you have some very, you know, very specific intel that's within the realm of possibility. But on rare occasions, that can be a very, very pleasant experience where you're investing in what looks like a good project at good value, and then unexpectedly, it gets a lot better.
All right, Matt, all great comments. Thank you very much for sharing kind of what you're doing in the sector, how you're looking at these junior companies, and all the financings that we are seeing, and a lot that were announced this week and undoubtedly going to continue to be announced as long as these financing windows remain open. These companies need money, and they need money just to keep the lights on, and then further money to go do some programs here to actually move their projects forward. Always a pleasure chatting with you, Matt. Again, you can check out Matt over at the MJG Capital website, which we will link to within that weekend show posting. We'll chat with Matt again next month. Matt, thank you for your time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.